Good evening and welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Tonight is our second to last seminar of this semester's series on the science and management of invasive species. Over the semester, we've had various experts come to campus and speak about their research, their management, and other information related to invasive species in our state, region, and around the world. And you can catch up on any of those previous presentations by going to mcla.edu/greenliving. Next week, April 27th, is our last lecture of this spring series. Ken Gooch from the Massachusetts DCR will be here. His lecture was originally scheduled for February. It was snowed out, so he'll be here next week to speak about invasive forest pests of Massachusetts. Tonight's presentation is a little different from previous weeks. First, we'll have a presentation from Dr. Joe Roman, followed by the opportunity to do some sampling of foods prepared with invasive species by Chef Greg Roach. Let me introduce Greg to you. Greg Roach is the executive chef at the Buxton School, an arts-oriented boarding school in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where he oversees student nutrition, the professional kitchen staff, and teaches gastronomy-oriented winter study courses. He's been cooking professionally for over 30 years in almost every type of American kitchen, from Michelin-starred restaurants to the overnight shift at a steak and eggs diner in rural Minnesota. His experiences include stints working with names like Charlie Trotter, Wolfgang Puck, and Jimmy Schmidt as executive chef for Wild Oats Market. Greg holds degrees from the University of Michigan and the Culinary Institute of America. After about 30 minutes into tonight's presentation, Chef Roach will have the opportunity to share some of the things that he's prepared with us this evening. So now let me introduce tonight's feature speaker, Dr. Joe Roman. Joe Roman is a conservation biologist, researcher, and educator at the University of Vermont. His book, listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act, won the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award in 2012. His science and nature writing has appeared in the New York Times, New Scientist, Audubon, Slate, among others. Joe is the founder and editor-in-chief of the website Eat the Invaders. He received his PhD from Harvard University in 2003 in organismic and evolutionary biology and his master's degree in wildlife ecology and conservation from the University of Florida. Born and raised in New York, Joe considers King Kong as an early conservation influence, and you can find out more about Joe from his website, joeroman.com. Please help me welcome Dr. Roman to MCLA.
Thank you all for coming. I know you've had some pretty formal lectures over the course of the semester. This one is a little bit looser, and feel free to ask questions. We can make it a conversation. That'd be totally fine. A couple of years ago, I was introduced, just like Dan's lovely introduction, except the woman said that I got my PhD in orgasmic and revolutionary biology at Harvard, and I am still looking for that major. If it's at MCLA, please let me know. Dan mentioned that I got my PhD at Harvard, and this was my field area. This is the coast of Maine. Some of you probably recognize it. Beautiful coastline, and I worked from Provincetown, Massachusetts, all the way up to Cape Breton in Nova Scotia. Beautiful landscape, but there was an invasion underfoot going underway at the time when I was searching for a particular species. My research species was Carcinus maenas. I imagine the European green crab, have you guys heard about that the course of the semester? So this species, highly invasive. It's been in the United States since 1817 was the first recorded presence of this species off the coast. Two records at the same time, off Long Island in New York and also off of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And it had been found in that area south of the Cape for almost 100 years. It wasn't found north of Cape Cod. After the construction of the Cape Cod Canal, the species started to expand its range. It may have been coincidental, or it may have been that it used the canal that was built between the Cape, built through the Cape at that time to move north. And it moved slowly north across the next two centuries until the 1990s, when the population exploded around Nova Scotia. So moving rather slowly, and it's how many of you have seen European green crabs looking in the intertidal. I just wonder if you guys know what they look like. Just a few. Well, if you were to go to the sort of in the Rocky intertidal in Massachusetts or Maine, this is the most common species. And you can tell when it's there because the native species are gone. So it makes a big difference. One scientist thought that maybe, so the pattern of dispersal is, or the currents are going south, southwest. So it's moving up. They were estimating that perhaps it was just the adult crabs that were moving up the coastline at that time. So what I wanted to do is look at that. You see these ballast bricks here, and that's probably how it got in. The adults probably came in through ballast bricks that were taken to Europe. They would take in from Europe, put the cargo here in North America, and then pick up cargo here in North America, drop the bricks, and then go. So I wanted to look at this invasion pattern. Why look at Carcinus? Well, I would consider, if you wanted to design an invasive species, this would be what you would do. You would make the European green crab. It has high fecundity. Females can produce more than 200,000 eggs per year. Good dispersal potential. The larvae stay in the plankton for up to 60 days. It grows rapidly. So the carapace width of 7 centimeters in just 2 years. And it can eat pretty much anything. It's very flexible. It can survive as a carnivore, an herbivore, a detritivore, but it really likes mollusks. In fact, when the green crab got into Massachusetts and Maine, there was a collapse of the softshell clam industry there. Big loss of the economy at that point. So that's what it prefers. It can also, you take it out of the water, it can survive for more than 10 days. So it can survive for a long time. So that, it has also a broad thermal tolerance and flexible physiology. Those really are probably the hallmarks in invasive species. We talk about climate change with native species. This guy is going to be around. Given this thermal tolerance, it's really going to do well in a changing world. So in order to look at this invasion pattern, one of the things I do is I study population genetics. I wanted to look at how that invasion proceeded throughout this area, thinking that probably in its original invasion point, there'd be lots of diversity and then less diversity as we went north, because there would be a founder population going north. So to look at that, I collected crabs from Freeport, New York, all the way to Prince Edward Island, stopping every 50 kilometers to look for these crabs. Not a bad gig. This shows you the Bay of Fundy. You guys know what the Bay of Fundy is famous for? Big tides, 50-foot tides, can be more, can be 60-foot tides. And green crabs can be pretty tough. You might be able to see there's a little gash on my head here. It's not from a green crab. I banged my head this morning in my basement. But they're known as crab enragé in French. So they're known as sort of the enraged, angry crab. So given the tides and the fierceness of the crabs, I decided rather than collect them myself, I'd use 10-year-olds. And really, this was part of the reason that I started thinking about what I'm going to talk about today, about eating invasives, because kids love getting out there and collecting these crabs. That's Nora Overhill. I met her in Canada. She was traveling on vacation with her mom, and they continue to collect crabs for me as they traveled on their vacation. And these are two boys in the Faroe Islands who I met, also who helped me collect these. Later on, I went to look where the invasion source was. So it started giving me an idea that people, kids especially, like to get out and collect these species. So why do we care about invasives? Well, you guys have heard this probably through the course of the semester, so I'll go through this very quickly. Maybe a few of the folks that are from the public. One is, it's one of the top causes of extinction. You can see here the rosy wolf snail right there, predatory snail released in the South Pacific to take on other herbivorous pest snails, but it turns out it's caused the extinction already of more than 50 snail species on those islands, and most of the remaining native species in that area survive only in zoos. One example, you could spend an entire semester looking at the impacts on biodiversity, but today I'm not going to do that too much. I'll give you one other example, and this is one of the species that we'll talk about later. This is the lionfish found, got into Florida in the 1980s. And looking at stomach contents of this invasive species, they found that 50% of the stomach contents for the species in Belize are the critically endangered social wrasse. So they're actually possibly going to cause the extinction of a critically endangered species. Again, lots of other examples. They also can change entire habitats. So this shows you the Aleutian Islands. So before 1841, no terrestrial mammals on Aleutian Islands. What would that mean? What do you think would be found there if there's no terrestrial mammals? What would do well on islands like this? I think I heard it. What's that? Seabirds, right. So these were really important areas for seabirds. But in the 19th century, Russian fur traders started introducing the Arctic fox throughout these islands. And the islands changed. I mean, seabirds, not only did the seabirds disappear, but the grasslands that were found there were transformed. You can see it on the right, into these low-lying shrubs. Their nutrients were taken out of the system. The seabirds were bringing guano into that area. This shows you a study from Kroll et al. In 2005. Good news is they're starting to remove those foxes from areas, and you're seeing these grasslands return. You're seeing more nutrients, the phosphorus. This is the areas where the foxes have been removed, where they're found. Biomass goes up. Phosphates go up, and of course, seabird densities go up. So they can actually transform entire habitats. Also, a lot of the diseases that we talk about these days are invasive. Malaria, most forms of malaria are invasive to the New World. People don't realize that. They came in probably in the ballast water of ships. West Nile virus came in 1980s, possibly through birds. In the Bronx Zoo, but it's an invasive mosquito and an invasive virus that transforms that. And white nose syndrome, those of you who grew up here, I know I'm living in Vermont. I'm a liberal flatlander, as you said. I grew up in New York. But I've been living in Vermont for about 12 years, and I've seen, when we moved into our house, there were lots of bats around there. Now, I almost never see bats right now. So white nose syndrome, it's a fungus that got in from Europe. So it can really, those diseases, it's a human health concern, but also a concern for us. And of course, it's also costly. We spend about $120 billion a year trying to, in either losses to crops or to health, and also trying to control it in control efforts. And why I'm going to, what I'm going to eventually get to, which is the invaders idea, why this concept can take off is because invasives are all around us. We could go for a walk after this and find lots of invasive plants. The starlings, the English sparrows, lots of species are invasive. All right. So what did I find in my research at that time? So here you see that transport. So it looked like Carcinus maenas had gone north, but actually what happened in the 1990s was a release of ballast water, and the species took off throughout that area. In really just 10 years, the populations exploded. In that northern area where we thought it might be too cold for them, when I did the genetics, it looks like the source for this northern population came from Norway. So they might be cold adapted and very highly diverse because it's coming through ballast water, and the ballast in ships can release millions of larvae in a single ship, and multiple ships are coming through. So two different pathways showing the relationship between these. So the point is that there are multiple invasions going on all the time. When I started my PhD, we were thinking, how are invasives so successful if they have reduced genetic diversity, if it's just a few of them coming through? Looks like they're coming in all the time. So it's not just a few propagules, but the expansion of these species through lots of individuals. In fact, the area in North America now has higher diversity in most populations in Europe because it's coming from multiple areas. So they're getting genes from different parts of the entire range and is now mixed. And this pattern we see around the world. So this shows you a study we did in 2008. That red lineage is the one that came through in New York. It's the most abundant in Europe. That's the native range there in the box. But you can see this each delineates a different genetic haplotype for this species. You can see there's lots of diversity. In fact, that's two different species in Japan that have invaded there. So we see this pattern of invasions with widespread multiple invasions going on often. Also important is once a species gets into a new area, like Massachusetts, this area here, that is a potential for causing secondary invasions. So as it turns out, the this group right here in California got there only about 10, 20 years ago. These came from the New York or Massachusetts region. Similarly, Argentina came from an area probably in Australia. So once they get in a new area, they can spread. By the way, Carcinus is now found pretty much anywhere it can be found. We've released them into that area. So while I was out there collecting green crabs in Nova Scotia, Bay of Fundy, about 2001, I noticed that there were other people also mucking around in the intertidal. And I was like, huh, what are they collecting? And I went over and chatted with the guy, and he had two buckets full of periwinkles, which is the common periwinkle is another invasive species. It's a gastropod. You can see it up there. Very abundant. Millions of them can be found along the stretch of a single shore, of like a kilometer of shoreline. They weren't collecting them for science, though. They were selling them to markets in New York and Boston. So these are eaten in Asian markets and also Italian markets. That's when I got an idea. I mean, I spend my career trying to stop overexploitation of species. That's what I do. I talk about endangered species. I work on endangered species extensively. And like, you know, actually, he's out there collecting it, and this would be a great way. There's no reason for there to be any limits on harvesting the species. In fact, the more we take, the better it'll be for the environment. So while I was sitting out there, I actually thumbed through a book by Yule Gibbons. He was a forager well known in the 60s and 70s, and he had recipes for the periwinkle and the European green crab. So I made them, and they were delicious. Soft-shell green crabs taste really good. I'm like, maybe this is something we could actually promote. Why don't we try and convince people to eat some of these species and take the pressure off the native species? This isn't only my idea. This is actually a picture of my grandmother. And she, whenever she went to the beach, she wouldn't waste a day at the beach. She loved the beach, but she'd also collect mussels and clams and periwinkles. So I put together a recipe based on her original tomato sauce to start thinking of a way to promote it. I mean, this is because people in the native areas, her family came from Italy, where they typically ate these. So a lot of these species are considered delicacies in their native land, but once they get to this new land, the new world, people are like, well, I don't know, I never tried Asian carp, or I've never really had a snail. So, you know, it's unfamiliar. So can we try and convince people that these are good to eat, and you guys are the guinea pigs tonight. So you're going to tell us whether they actually are tasty. I have tried this with my students a couple of weeks ago. So in 2004, I wrote an article for Audubon Magazine. You can see it over there, Eat Your Invasives. And there's one. I called up chefs from around the country, celebrity chefs at that time. Jacques Papin is a chef based out of Connecticut, had a big TV show. He said he had just eaten periwinkles that day with his brother. So he gave me a recipe. Alice Waters, based out of Berkeley, provided a recipe. This came from Prejean's, which is a well-known restaurant in New Orleans, and put this idea forward. And honestly, the response was kind of silence. It was like, oh, it's kind of a funny, cute idea. But it didn't really get a lot of momentum until the foraging movement started to take off about 5, 6, 7 years ago, and the local boar idea, the idea of eating locally sourced ingredients. And then we really started to get, after that, a lot of attention to this idea, because chefs were starting to think, just like Greg in the back, well, maybe there's some ways that we can actually use these species. And this is Bun Lai, who's one of the chefs that I've worked with. He's based out of New Haven. a piece in Outside Magazine. What Bun was, Bun is, you know, is a funny guy anyway, but he's the only one I know that decided he could eat Asian shore crabs. Small crab like this, I'd seen them by the thousands in my field work. I figured that's kind of like zebra mussels. No one's going to want to touch it. But he sautés it with an Old Bay, and it's described as Doritos with legs. And they're actually really good. So next time, I'll try and I now live in Vermont. I'm not as close to the coast, or we would bring you some periwinkles and some shore crabs as well. And this is the website that we've put together, I think since about 2011, 2012, focusing on some of these species that can be, in some areas, relatively easily accessed, and looking for recipes either from native countries or ones that are developed here in the United States. The European green crab, its closest relative, Carcinus estuarii, is actually a delicacy in Venice. Maybe some would say, what isn't a delicacy in places like Venice? They're eaten as soft-shell crabs in the spring. It's called moleque. And then in the fall, the females with ripe ovaries are highly desirable, masanete. And those of you guys who take in conservation biology, if you want to reduce the species, go after the gravid females, right? I mean, so this is really a way that you might be able to take that out. The problem in getting soft shells, which, by the way, are delicious, at least as good, though somebody, if anyone grew up in the Chesapeake, you might take issue with me, at least as good as blue crabs, especially if you're just pulling them out of the water that day and cooking them up. The problem is that unlike blue crabs, where their fishermen know when they're going to peel, they're called peelers. They know the season, and they have cues in the just before they're going to molt. We haven't had them for green crabs until very recently. So when I've given this talk a couple years ago, I would leave it at that. The good news is that just recently, last year, there's been some research in Prince Edward Island looking for those cues. So this is the European green crab. So can they tell when they're about to molt? So then they can. Then they become very valuable. There's not a lot of meat on these, so eating them as hard shell isn't going to sell it for everyone. So one thing is looking at season. So what time of year are they going to molt? And then are there cues there? So this really, I think, is possibly a promising way to control green crabs in North America, at least. Last week, actually, these are my students at UVM. We had them eat European green crabs and periwinkles. So you guys aren't my first guinea pigs. And they seem to enjoy them. That's the periwinkle there. And this is a green crab bisque. The hard shells, again, there's not a lot of meat in it. So they can be more of a challenge. My friends who are from Asia don't have a problem taking apart these, but most Americans are like, there's just too little meat. It's too much work. Any questions or thoughts before I keep going? No, let's see, hands up. Cool. So a couple of the species that are local, that are abundant, that you guys can actually go out. We were talking about, Dan and I, getting some garlic mustard there, and Greg, but there, it's just not up yet. Has it come up yet? Not as of like a couple of days ago. Abundant. It really is a problem. It can outcompete native flowers. It can even destroy entire forests because it's disrupting the relationship between the tree seedlings and the soil fungi in that area, and abundant. So this is a map of where garlic mustard, Aliaria petiolata, is found, widespread, abundant, and, as it turns out, makes an excellent pesto. And one thing I would say, if you are going to do this, if you are harvesting these, take the whole plant. Like, don't just take a few leaves. You can do that too. But if you want, remove the whole plant and be careful. Don't transport it. This, we'll talk about some of the concerns about eating invasives. And one that I have is, don't move them around alive. Make sure this doesn't go into, like, you take it from one area and you throw it in your compost bin and you're spreading it. The key is you have to make sure that you're not spreading it when you're consuming it. So I didn't put the dots on all of them, but I put, like, green light. You guys, some of you may have seen those, the fisheries seafood cards put out by Monterey Bay. and other areas saying what species are good to eat, one, what you might be careful about and what you shouldn't eat. Well, something like garlic, mustard, green light. As long as you know where you harvest, as long as you're taking it from an area that you're not concerned that there's pesticides or something in the area, certainly one that can be easily abundant, easily prepared. This is the rusty crayfish. It's actually native to this area here, native to the upper Midwest, but it's been introduced, you can see it in the red there, including in, here in Massachusetts, and in Vermont. It's really, unfortunately, in many of the river systems here, it's the most abundant crayfish. And another one that is very easy to prepare. It's basically you make a crawfish boil. And the state of Arizona encourages people. It's also, there's another invasive species there. Their catchphrase is millions of Cajuns can't be wrong. I've done this. I've harvested them up in Vermont. And this, again, is one that's simple to prepare and really quite tasty. And to go with along with all those foods, you can also make beer and wine from these plants. This is dandelion and burdock beer, so everyone knows dandelion, invasive species here. Also burdock, which is, has a thick root. And have you guys seen burdock? It also has those, it has burrs. Some say that inspired, what was it? Velcro, thank you. Said that it was inspired Velcro. If you get it that first year, you can pull up the roots, and the roots are actually quite tasty. They're eaten in Japan, but you can also make lots of interesting beverages from these things. So one concern is, this is kudzu here, I mean, can we really eat our way out of this mess, right? Is really going to be a few of us in this artisan, I mean, a lot of this is just, I started this as like individual foraging. Is that going to really make a dent? At first I'd say no, but I think the evidence is coming around that maybe actually we can make a dent in some of these species. Certainly if we went back 200 years, people would have thought there's no way you could put an end to passenger pigeons. This was one of the most abundant vertebrates on the planet at that time, a painting of what it might, well, a fanciful painting of what it might have looked like with millions or billions of passenger pigeons flying, as you all know. That came to an end in 1914. This is the last individual, Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. Our appetites are voracious, and we struggle with that all the time with wild species. With invasive species, though, it's one of those times where I would say, have at it. And in fact, the key is to, from the start, you want to say, a lot of times I'll get calls about this, like, well, this is a really good sustainable fishery or a sustainable hunt. It's like, actually, the goal isn't sustainability here. We're actually trying to reduce these populations. So it's counterintuitive. People are surprised by that. But you're not trying to make these a sustainable harvest, but really one where you're trying to reduce it. It also has an impact. I mean, think about where our food comes from. If we're eating it from the wild, it could put a little bit less pressure on the way we go to the supermarket. And we're getting all these processed foods that are wrapped up by eating and learning about native species, rather invasive and native species, knowing what's invasive, what's native. You guys already have had a whole semester of this, so you have a sense of what species might be native or invasive, but most people don't know. They might have heard of a zebra mussel, but they're not going to necessarily know what species are native and what are invasive. This is a good way to learn it and also eat from the local ecosystem. You don't only have to eat these species. This is a friend of mine, Rule Beaumont, who uses, I'm forgetting what species now it is. It's the invasive European tree. I'll get back to you. I'm drawing a blank on which species he uses, but it's one that's highly abundant in Vermont. Also, people are using goats to reduce things like kudzu and other invasive species. So it's not only about eating it, but you can also use other species or even burn the invaders as it is. And some species are harder to convince people to try than others. This is nutria. It's a rodent, a large rodent from South America, got into Louisiana. People have tried to sell that as food, and I showed you that picture from Prejean's. They're also trying to promote it as a fashion. I mean, in South America, it is hunted for its fur. I don't know if this is going to make any of you guys run out and try and buy Nutria, but it's actually also sold as dog food. So that's marsh dog there. So that's another alternative for this species. So there are other options beyond just eating them directly, other uses for these species, for sure. And for me, it's really just an opportunity to get outside, to learn about that local ecosystem. You guys have the knowledge, the students that are in this class. You've had a whole semester of invasive species, so you can get out there and start looking for these and think about creative ways, creative things to do with them. One, it's a good way to educate people, but it's also a good way to learn about it and actually have a delicious meal. And speaking of that, now is the opportunity for you guys to try it. When I first spoke to Greg, we were going to get lionfish today, so that's why I chose the lionfish here. Greg, you want to say what happened when you tried to get lionfish for the meal today, for our tasting?
Lionfish. I thought for sure somebody would be selling it on the website down in the state, run by the state of Florida, telling fishmongers and fishermen where they can sell their lionfish, and they were dozens and dozens of places. Turns out that it has become extremely popular in Florida. And nobody wants to sell small quantities to people. It's kind of funny. It's actually that eating the invaders appears to be working. The demand is so high and the supply is so limited that it's extremely difficult to get. And the couple of chances that I did have was a frozen one for $80, which I passed by. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even sure that he really had that one in stock. But it's a whole other story. Fish purveyors are shitty guys.
That's a whole other lecture.
Yeah. And that brings up a whole other discussion about can these things be commercially viable without creating a demand that would, at some point, people would want there to be more lionfish down off the coast of Florida. Would people, on a good side, maybe they could find a way to farm it. On a bad side, inland farming, not offshore farming. This is a giant can of worms. You are not eating worms tonight, George. And it's interesting. There are some invasives that they'll just never get completely rid of, I'm convinced, like the Asian carp, which you'll be trying tonight. But unlike Asian carp, which there are gazillions of them now up and down the Mississippi watershed, lionfish appears to be able to be beaten back by human consumption.
Yeah, so certainly with lionfish, the populations are better. So they're mostly harvested by spearfishing, so you can't catch them hook or line. So basically, it's limited by how far people are going to dive to catch them. So there are refuges. The deep water lionfish are probably doing okay, unfortunately. But you are seeing, and I'll show you some slides. I'm going to let you guys go get the food, and then I'll talk a little bit more about it. Greg, do you want to tell them what you have out there and where they are before everyone gets up, and then you guys go ahead and help yourselves.
Watercress, which is aquatic invasive plant, and we have a watercress and avocado salad with a little bit of pickled ginger. We have wakame or wakame salad, which is the salad you see in almost every sushi bar. But in the United States and up and down the West Coast, it's invasive and grows wild. Unfortunately, it's tough to get foraged wild. So this is actually farmed seaweed. I believe it comes from Japan. I import. We also have so I have a little bit of dry wakame over here that we could buy something like the Sitwilos or at the Asian market over in Albany. We have wild boar meatballs and a hoisin barbecue sauce. The wild boar is from Texas. Let's see. These are the Asian carp tacos. Those are the crazy flying carp that navigated the Mississippi River, and I found at least a couple of fish shops up and down the Mississippi River that are making a pretty good killing selling these back to Asia. They have, you know, the Vietnamese translation right there on their page, and a special number to call if you want to place an order from Vietnam. It was very enlightening. And last, this came from Paducah, Kentucky.
So that is a wild invasive.
This is a wild invasive. This was caught somewhere in the Mississippi watershed.
And I'll show you some slides afterwards so you guys will get an idea of where to go.
And then last but not least, the one that I think everybody from Buxton showed up for. You're all familiar with the Asian soup dish, pho, noodles, broth. We have python pho tonight. And little samples here. The python came from a company in California. I'm not sure if it's wild. I'm not sure if it's farmed. They do farm it in Vietnam, I discovered. It's one of those interesting things that I don't know enough about. I did find that it didn't, it's a rather nondescript flavor, but very chewy. There's only a little tiny bit in the broth. So it's not like rattlesnake, which I've had, which is really quite tasty, actually. We've got condiments, a little bit of sambal leek, if you like it spicy, sambal. We've got sriracha, cholula, for anybody who wants to mix them. Flavors in theirs, and I'm trying to think.
All right, help yourselves, and I'll chat about these while you guys are.
Be careful with the tripod. My one request, and also limit yourself to one fork and one spoon. Please reuse them on the thing because we only have enough. And then we'll try to find a trash can so we can keep the mess contained.
Thank you, Greg. What do you guys think? Yeah? How's the wild boar? Anyone have it? Awesome. How about the Asian carp? Well, so let's talk about some of the things you're eating. First, because I thought we were going to get lionfish, I will mention that. This probably, as Greg said, is maybe the most well-known species that's actually is sold in markets. Whole Foods has started selling it in California, maybe one of the reasons you had a hard time. There's a group called Reef that is put together a cookbook, and even NOAA, even the feds are encouraging the consumption of this. As I had mentioned, one of the challenges is catching them below areas where people are comfortable diving. Just this week or in the past couple of weeks, there's been a robot that's been designed to catch these so that you can set it up to 1,000 feet in depth. And it's basically, they're using a little camera, so they're remotely moving the robot around to capture them. So we may see that even the deeper ones are going to be vulnerable as well. So again, lionfish, when I first started out on this, people would ask, well, does it work? And I'm like, well, I think it will. We see it with native species, they decline. But there's actually evidence now, and this isn't really a surprise. When you fish species hard, the population declines. Here's a study area in Bonaire where they had fishing pressure in one area and unfished species, or rather an unfished area, and you can see it right there. The biomass declines steeply when you have an area that's heavily harvested. I give the green, the lionfish, like the green, go for it. It's tasty. Most people are comfortable with it. It's a firm white fish. So, it's one that I think really is going to be very, popular, even if, as Greg said, it's still hard to source. Though I've been talking to a company that's trying to do online distribution. So you may see that change. Certainly restaurants in the Southeast. I work in Cuba, and food security is an issue. People are hungry there. You rarely see a lionfish. The government encourages the consumption, and populations are way down. The good news is, even if we don't eradicate these species, if you reduce the numbers, it has an influence on native species. So this is a journal article that came out in 2014, and it shows if it's green or yellow, they basically subjected lionfish to different levels of fishing pressure. And you can see on that, the one on the upper left, native fish biomass goes up significantly if you put pressure on the lionfish. It's not necessary to eradicate them, but if you can suppress populations, it has an effect. Those are for medium-sized fish. Their initial study didn't show that much difference for the larger fish, the ones that lionfish can't actually eat, but that's actually showing that probably it's working. The one, their prey is actually rebounding, and the species that they're not feeding aren't necessarily influenced by that. So the fishing pressure works, and you can see an effect on native species in that area. What you're eating right now, wild boar, wild pig, DeSoto, when he came first to North America, released he traveled with several dozen wild pigs at that time. Several of them got out, escaped, and since that time, we've been releasing wild pigs, either whether they've been domestic swine that jumped the fence or wild boar that are released in that area. And this shows you up top where they're currently found and where they've been recorded. They're widespread in North America. This shows you, use it looking at temperature and other factors where they're likely to occur. In the future, the populations are booming and are likely to expand. So if it's red, it's high probability of occurrence, and blue is a low probability of occurrence. What you're eating here are ones that come from Texas. One of the problems is, it concerns with, just like any swine, with parasites. The good news is, don't worry, they actually have USDA certification on site at this area where they're hunted. That was been the problem for selling it commercially. Hunters can eat them, but in order to sell it commercially, of course, it has to be inspected. So these have been inspected by having mobile inspection units that's allowed them to start selling these commercially. And the python that you're eating, I'm certain that it's not a wild python coming by. I'm certain that it's not legally a wild python that you guys are eating. It's farm-raised. It's why I would say, and this is one from the Everglades. As you may know, it's the pythons. Burmese pythons were released in the Everglades probably by pet collectors, either inadvertently or on purpose. And it's a huge impact on wildlife in the Everglades. This is showing native biomass before and after the release of Burmese pythons. These are for different species of mammals. Green is before the python got in, and red is after the python. And you can see numbers of lot. They basically drop off the map. They're doing transects on roads, looking for wild mammals, and they're basically gone in areas where the python is found. So it's had a huge effect on the Everglades ecosystem. I wouldn't necessarily encourage, so I would give this a yellow because there's some concerns, not the ones you guys are eating, about heavy metals coming out in that area. Unfortunately, the Everglades is contaminated. It'd be true of anything you ate out of the Everglades. So whether this is one that's good for a market remains to be seen. Maybe better to make shoes out of them or something if we're going to actually use them. There are heavy bounties for the species. And yeah, good. Any questions?
Why has the rat gone up?
Good. I guess they're consuming larger mammals. And I don't know. I could give you two. Yeah, they're taking out the predators. The predators are going out for the rats. A rat pop, their predator release in that area, unfortunately. And feel free to ask questions, whether about what you're eating or other things. And then this is the Asian carp that you're eating, another one that I would give a green. This one, it's healthy, it's pretty tasty, it's super abundant, and there's now a commercial. You can buy it commercially, as you guys know, because you're eating it right there. But here's the range. So there are three species of carp that are called collectively the Asian carp. And there you can see the known range of that of these species. The concern is they're going to get into the Great Lakes. They're already having a huge impact on the Mississippi. Again, one can encourage eating it here, but another option is to actually sell it back to Asian markets, where it's very popular. They were brought here, I think some of them were brought here for pest control, other for aquaculture, and then again, they jumped the pen and got out, typically probably in a storm. And then the other thing you're eating is wakame, widespread invasive species, kind of like the green crab. Those colors show you different genetic markers for wakame. And so it's native to this area, to Japan, but all that other area is invasive. If you see red, that's actually crop. So it's aquaculture that's been released there. That they tried aquaculture in Europe, and now it's widespread throughout Europe. The bluer ones probably got in through ballast water. There wasn't agriculture there, but you can see now it's found around the world. I give it a yellow only because, as Greg said, it's kind of hard to get the wild one. Most of the time, it's like eating any other agriculture. It's not bad or good. It's just that it's coming probably from a farm. If you were to go to the store, I don't know that they're being sold from California at this point. It's possible, but I know it's hard to source that unless you're in California and you're collecting itself. There's a relative actually on the East Coast too that friends of mine do eat, so it is possible in that area. And then you've got watercress here. This one is really, I think, is pretty hard. And so watercress, if you want to eat it, it's delicious. I hope you guys are enjoying it. But I would say in that case, harvest it yourself, unless you know a local forager who says they got it. For the most part, that's probably going to be commercially raised, and it's an agricultural product that's probably at risk of being released in those areas. So I would say, and it's great to eat it, and it's, you know, but probably not one that I would go to the store and buy. If you harvest it yourself, sure, that's fine. And you can see it's found pretty much everywhere in North America right now. So if you decide you like it, it's pretty much anywhere you're going to be able to find it. So I want to be transparent about this. There are some people challenge this idea, including Dan Simbeloff. You might have heard his name or read something by him if you guys are doing invasives. He works at the University of Tennessee. He's definitely a skeptic of this idea. I'm fine with that. I'm not going to be defensive on it. These are the concerns. They actually put benefits in their paper too, but I've already discussed those benefits. So these are the concerns they've had. One is that it might not really affect the population size, the expansion, or the growth of those. I've given you some examples of some species where it has and others where it can. But certainly, I mean, you know, we had kudzu sorbet in that article for Audubon Magazine. That's the blossoms of the kudzu. That's not going to, it's just kind of a quirky, fun thing, but it's, you know, that's not a way we're going to beat kudzu. Maybe the goats are, and then you can eat the goats, but the kudzu, you're doing a lot of the times that's probably true. The other concern, I think Greg maybe mentioned that, you know, it's the creating a market can be problematic because people are going to want to maintain it. It's like, oh man, I love lionfish and now it's gone. Let's get some more out there. You have to be clear from the front that the goal here is reducing those populations. If you're not clear about that, then I think that is a legitimate concern. I think the biggest concern for me, and if anything about this would keep me up at night, it's that it would promote further invasions, that people says, oh my God, this Asian carp is awesome. We should have it in Lake Champlain. You know, that would be, then you would lose everything. All the gains would be wiped away and it would make it worse. I honestly think the risk of that, personally, is low. One is because it's still, it's mostly a bunch of greenies that are doing, you know, it's people that like to go out and forage and people are pretty aware of that, but I could be wrong. That would be a serious concern if people spread them because they decided that. So I think this probably is the one that I would be most concerned about. And then, and this one maybe also, you know, if people decided, well, lionfish in Florida are awesome and now they're gone. You know, if you're promoting cultural value on these species, maybe people would want to keep them around more. So far, that hasn't happened. I would argue, well, look at our management of fisheries. we value cod. There are no cod. You know, the cod is down to well below 1%. So our track record, even when these species have cultural value, unfortunately, is pretty bad. If we're saying out front, the goal is reducing it, I think, we'd probably be pretty comfortable. I'm comfortable with that, but I am totally open to anyone challenging me. You guys can say, you know, I'd be interested to see what you guys think about that. The key, though, is that, you know, I think this is fun, and I enjoy doing this, and I really find that people tend to be pretty open to it, but we're not going to consume our way out of every mess. There are lots of invasives that are not edible, and even more importantly, prevention is really, you guys have heard this already, I'm not telling you anything new. Prevention is the best way, right? You do not want to allow any new invasives in. And one is ballast water controls, because that's what I study. I'm concerned about species that I get in through ballast. But I think really key, and I don't know if this has been discussed through the semester, is the policy should be you can't bring a species in unless it's shown not to be invasive. Right now, you guys have already heard about the Lacey Act. The way it is now is if they're on the list, you can't bring it in. So if they're listed, if there's a federal, if it's part of the Lacey Act that says you can't import this species, then it's restricted. The problem is that Burmese python is now on that list, but it wasn't when it was released. It's too late. So really what we should be doing is thinking of laws of making it preventative. That's the most important thing. And again, never move a living invasive species. Make sure that you don't release it. I think e-invasives can be helpful in rapid response and monitoring because people are out there. They're looking around. The more educated as you guys are about this, you may find, oh, I didn't know this species was here. How surprising. I've certainly come across that with finding green crabs or something like a new species in the area. Unfortunately, it's happening all the time. You want to hit them hard, fast. You know, you can't have a delay. And then I would say this is where eating invasives lies, in that awareness, education to control spread, and then also just having sort of like this group. Now you've learned a bit about a few of these species, so you guys know anyway, because you've been taking an entire semester in this, but we need to get that message out to a broader audience. And as a colleague of mine said when I called him, in this case, extinction is actually a happy ending. So, you know, eat away. This was an invasive meal that I had up in Vermont. By the way, daylilies are awesome. When you guys see them, especially as blossoms, you might not realize it, but that's one that's really simple. You just fry it up quickly. It's really tasty. And these are white perch that we collected from Lake Champlain. These are some of my colleagues that have helped me out through the years, and with that, I'm happy to take questions, and also questions for Greg if you have them. Yeah.
When you said don't bring in new species unless shown to be non-invasive, how is one to determine that?
Yeah, there are, well, so you know that list that I showed you with the European green crab, there are certain characteristics that species can be very invasive. Generally, they're generalists. They have a wide range, and they've been shown in other areas to expand rapidly. So there are a series of characteristics that you would go through, and you'd say, literally like a checklist, well, does it have this characteristic? And if it's no, then you can bring it in. If it's one or two yeses, then you say, well, look, and Idaho actually has a state law, not the most liberal state in the country, but they have a state law that says no, you can't bring in any species there unless you show, as the importer, that they're not invasive. It's a good question. Yep.
Why are these Asian jumping out of the park, jumping out of the water?
I don't know. It's a good question. I wish I had a good answer to that. I know they are responding to the boat noise, but why they do that is an excellent question. We could get back to that. They're called jumping carp. Maybe somebody wants to Google it while we chat. But I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah.
Are the zebra mussels edible?
They're edible, but they're not really very tasty. They kind of have a smell, but and they're tiny. But sure, they're edible. But for the most part, not one likely that you're going to put on pasta. Though I've been tempted to try it, but I haven't done it yet. I'll get back to you the next time if I actually get around to it. They're certainly abundant enough in Lake Champlain where I live. Sure. Yep.
What are some of the things you guys are doing for, like, working on species that aren't edible? Like, are there any, like what do you do to, like, kind of get rid of those?
Excellent question. Yeah. So eradication efforts can be herbicides for plants. There are larvicides. So, you know, often it's poison or it's mechanical control. So Caulerpa, which is an invasive algae, that is widespread in the Mediterranean. It's clonal. When it got into California, divers and snorkelers went out and removed it, and it worked. You got to get it early. These in marine invasives, once they're in, and we're never going to get rid of lionfish or green crabs, but I will tell you one way that people have proposed to do it. So mechanical removal, you know, one scientist calls it the nasty necessity. I don't like killing animals, really. I mean, I hate the idea that I'm promoting this, but at the same time, on an individual animal welfare level, there's nothing wrong with a starling, a sparrow, or a green crab. You know what I mean? The individuals, they're as valid as anything else, but they're having a huge impact on the ecosystem. So it could be physical removal, herbicides. They've released diseases. They've released parasites. And you could probably think of some other control methods that have been used too. The one that's been knocked around now that I'd be interested to see what people feel about is, have you heard about the CRISPR gene? So it's basically you can turn a kill gene on to an organism. So it's been proposed, say, for mosquitoes, for example, carrying Zika virus is one example. They've been trying it, or for Lyme disease. So you could do that for species, theoretically. So you could actually take a gene and kill off that. And George Church, who's one of the developers for these, says he can... If it got to the wild, I'm like, well, what happens if it got to Europe? So if you took out European green crabs here, it got to Europe, well, I'd rather have European green crabs here than cause the extinction of it in its native range. He says they can shut it off, but, you know, that's what he says. You got, yeah, exactly. I mean, we all say a lot of things that make sense. So those are a few examples. I'm sure there are more than maybe people have. But that's the traditional way of doing it. Getting in early and hitting them hard actually works. There are lots of examples. Once it's widespread, it becomes really hard.
So historically, one of the ways people have tried to control invasive species is by introducing a predator.
Right.
Have you thought of anything in the idea of introducing a predator that might be tastier than the invasive species, controlling the control there?
No, not really. I'm not really big on point taken, and I really can't think of any examples where that has worked very well. I'm sure there are some. Maybe somebody can. I mean, there's been some release. You guys may know from this class. Certainly, I wouldn't want... the problem is that you'd have to be 100% sure that it's not going to eat other species, that it's a specialist only on this individual. There have been some successes with that, and there have certainly been many failures with that. I mean, think of the cane toad. I just showed you the rosy wolf snail. There have been lots of species that have been released to control pests of invasive, you know, they didn't use the term invasive, they were agricultural pests, they didn't care where they came from. And it has a pretty bad effect on biodiversity. So I wouldn't be 100% against it if you could show me with really strong certainty that they're not. Carcinus manus has a parasite it's a barnacle, it's actually a castrating barnacle. When population densities get high in Europe, the populations go down because the parasite's very common. You could bring it here. It's not here. But what happens if that barnacle could adapt to blue crabs? That would be a terrible move. So you better be really sure before you do that. We're a pretty good predator, generalist predator ourselves.
Are there any plants that we would be concerned about the seeds remaining viable, passing through the human digested?
Good point. I mean, so actually some of the goats wear diapers because you don't want them to go, right, spreading the seeds. I would say with people, because with septic systems and other things, maybe. I hadn't thought about that. That it's sure you'd have to be aware of that, but... Yeah, if we're eating the seeds, maybe. I think the risk for humans is pretty low. Well, maybe if you're camping, you know, you. But at the same time, you're probably just hiking up the road. So I don't know. I hadn't thought about that specifically. Certainly, that would be one dispersal mechanism. But again, I think the risk for that is pretty low.
I have a question for Greg about the ingredients you were using. Were they? I have zero chef knowledge, so. Were they different than using other kind of fish or other kind of ingredients?
The python in particular was my very first time using it, and I would do it very differently. I now see why over in Asia what they do is they stew it. It's a tough, you know, meat. And so, yeah, I learned something there. The carp, I got frozen carp. I can tell from the texture, a little mushy. I would probably, if I was a chef in Paducah, Kentucky, I wouldn't want to get it frozen. Has, you can tell because it breaks the cellular structure down a little bit and gets that very mushy texture. The wild boar is excellent. I hadn't used it before, aside from wild boar sausages. I've never worked with it raw. I will be working with it again. I'm not sure with sauce, but that's my culinary side coming up. You know, watercress and wakame and stuff, that's all part of my normal repertoire. That's lovely stuff. In the French and, you know, tea sandwiches and things like that, watercress have been going together for, you know, a couple hundred years, I'd say.
The wild boar, we did a tasting out in Colorado of Safeway natural pork, and then heritage pork, and then the wild swine. And their tastes were really different, because, you know, what you get at Safeway, or we're at, you know, that's a white, it's the new white meat, and it's always the same, and that, the farmers there want that. They're like, they consider the other two kind of trash because it's a complex flavor. It really does taste very different when you compare them side to side. It's just, you know, it's got different texture, and I find it delicious.
The heritage breed pork and the wild boar actually were closer than your traditional factory farm pork and a heritage breed pork. It's very interesting. Boston seems to be where you probably see wild boar on your menu.
Awesome.
And it's important too. I was really surprised that all the proteins here, wild boar, it appears to, you know, be viable commercially.
Like on the same order as buffalo, or?
Yeah, right along it. And to be honest, I like this more than buffalo because it's cheaper than, say, Berkshire pork is actually a breed of pig. It has nothing to do with where we live. But it's actually more affordable than Berkshire pork, and in my opinion, it tastes similar, if not better. I'm not sure about all the other cuts. I only bought it ground, but it's lovely. So yeah, there's obviously a market for it. From what I understand, they catch wild pigs when they're young, they neuter them and raise them until they're ready for harvest. And then, so that's sort of, what I'm hoping they're not doing is actually raising them farm style and then calling it wild.
You know, they're not, and they're hunted too.
Yeah.
You can buy them directly when they're hunted in the wild.
Yeah, I have had wild boar that was hunted, and it was male and mature, and it is tough and gamey and nothing like this. So it's a very different, absolutely different beast, no
problem. Is there any research being done on other uses for invasives, commercial uses, medicine, that kind of thing?
Sure, I mean, some of them, a lot of the herbs are medicinal. I don't know if it has a focus on invasives, so you know what I mean? It's just because, well, if you look at, I mentioned Martha Washington, she had the recipes when she died, like half of them are now invasive species because they like them and they brought them over from England. So there are lots of species that have potential kudzu is a hangover cure in Japan. But yes, absolutely. And then you can also use them for other things, like kudzu, for example, or you can make paper into it. So anything that we really use wild products for, invasives are, you know, going to be a good use for that, whether it's medicine or fabric or something like that, for sure. Well, I want to thank Chef Greg for preparing this today. It's awesome. Thank you guys. All right, thanks.